You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Welcome to The Past Macabre, where we journey through history to uncover how our relationship with death reflects the values, fears, and hopes that shape the way people live. I'm your host, Stephanie Rice. Thank you for joining me for episode 29, Ancient Fossil Finds and Mythical Creatures, Part 2, The Bones of Heroes and Monsters. It's the last part of the two-episode exploration of the archaeological and paleontological evidence of the connections between fossils and myths. In the previous episode, I shared the interdisciplinary evidence of the connection between dragon legends and fossils from ancient art and texts and the fossils that have been found in archaeological contexts. There's a lot of evidence that people have always spent time trying to understand the world around them by combining imagination with knowledge of the natural world. We still do it today. In this episode, I'll share even more examples of mythological beings connected to fossilized bones and tracks from areas we now call Mesoamerica, the American Southwest, Alaska, Ireland, and Greece. Similar to the examples from the previous episode, these aren't leaps made by comparing physical characteristics alone. These cultures have preserved texts, oral traditions, and art of the giant bones or tracks of long-extinct animals that were found by their ancestors. As you'll see, some descendant communities even know the exact spot or types of fossils traditionally associated with these finds. So now let's get started on the stories of physical evidence left behind by monsters, giants, heroes, and even gods. Indigenous cultures in what we now call North America had their own mythical beings and stories about creation that had their own potential paleontological roots. Some of the very first fossils that were studied by European paleontologists from North America were brought to them by the indigenous guides who knew exactly where to find them. Fossils have even been found at many indigenous archaeological sites that date back thousands of years before European contact. So people here very clearly knew about fossils and the fact that they belong to long extinct animals and where to find them, especially where to find them the most frequently, for countless generations. Just like the examples of dragon tails in the previous episode and other examples from around the world, these fossils likely inspired stories as people compared it to the known world around them. Descendants have continued to preserve and share these stories for many generations, and it's thanks to the efforts of culture keepers that researchers have begun to learn more about the indigenous knowledge of fossils and the myths that they associated with them, not necessarily spawned from them, as we'll see. First, we'll start in Mesoamerica, commonly known as Central America, which is like Mexico, Belize, Guatemala, etc. So the volcanic highlands there and basins stretch across central and southern Mexico, and there's also a lot of archaeological and paleontological layers that go on into the Yucatan Peninsula. They preserve marine fossils from when the area was underwater during the Cretaceous period, and there's fossils of megafauna from the Pleistocene, which includes mammoths and giant ground sloths especially. For the civilizations that thrived here before European contact, like the Olmec and then the Maya and then the Nahua, just to name a few, the land reflects these cycles of destruction and renewal that were a core part of their cosmogony or their world creation views. There are variations of the creation cycles and their origins across Mesoamerica because different groups would have variations that changed by a region or time period. Very similar to the myths from ancient Egypt, Greece, or Rome, you can't pinpoint just one origin myth. But I'm going to specifically share the creation myths that are from the Yucatec Maya, who have lived and still live in the Yucatan Peninsula, famous for Chichen Itza, and the Quiche of modern Guatemala, who are also under the Mayan-speaking umbrella, but they are different from the Yucatec Maya. Side note, the term Maya specifically comes from the Yucatec language. It's a dialect of what we now call the Mayan language, but that's what was applied across the board to the people who speak this Mayan language, as we call it. So the Quiche have their own language and their own traditions that are similar yet separate. And the name of Guatemala actually comes from their language. I'll also share information from the Mexica, which are widely known as the Aztecs, and they're the ones who Mexico is named after, and Mexico City was, and that region around it, was essentially their home area, and they're part of the broader Nahua ethnic group, and their descendants still live broadly across Mexico, and specifically a lot in Mexico City. These groups were chosen because their traditions are the best documented because they were recorded in the famous codices created by Spanish priests that have actually remained until modern times. There were a lot more codices that were created across Mesoamerica, but unfortunately, the church destroyed a vast majority of them, and the only ones that survive today were held in either private collections or stashed away and hidden. So we have very few remaining. But because of the ones that are remaining, a lot more research was done to also track the oral traditions that were passed down to modern descendants of the Yucatec Maya, the Quiche, and the Mexica. So that's why, in addition to the Spanish versions of their accounts, we also have more of their descendant versions as well. According to their traditions, the universe has gone through four ages, and we are living in the fifth. Each age ended in catastrophe, either a flood or a fire or earthquakes that wiped out most life, and a new world rose from the bones of the old. One of the most famous creation myths from Mesoamerica, it said that the god of wind and knowledge, Quetzalcoatl, also known as Kukulkan to the Yucatec Maya and Gucumatz of the Quiche Maya, created modern humans of the fifth sun that we're now living in by descending to the underworld to gather ancient giant bones from the beings who lived during the previous cycles. Now, modern researchers have found fossil beds full of megafauna across especially what used to be Mexica territory, which is the core of this creation myth. And it's not that these fossil beds specifically inspired the cosmology directly. It's more likely that they reinforced it in a way. So finding the bones of extinct mammals or even just the teeth or marine fossils that would have been covering the limestone of the area from when it was underwater, it would have seemed like uncovering proof that the earlier worlds did really exist and there was previous life, which ultimately is not wrong. There were these cycles and massive extinction events, just not so many humanoids until recent times. A specific example of one of these fossil beds is in 2020, during the construction of an airport, workers unearthed tons of Colombian mammoth skeletons. Since then, the site's been further excavated by paleontologists, and the construction of the airport was shifted a little bit. And they've discovered that it's the largest concentration of mammoth skeletons in the world, at least that's been found so far. South Dakota used to be the most famous, and this surpasses it by a lot. Over 600 individuals have been identified so far as of the beginning of 2025. So it wouldn't be surprising if someone stumbled across even a small portion of this many mammoths and then began to form comparisons with the monstrous creatures that were said to have been destroyed by their gods in the past cycles. According to another myth about Quetzalcoatl specifically that was preserved in the Florentine Codex, says that when he walked the earth, which was very rare, his footsteps were so hot that they melted the stone, and there was a place specifically identified as the place where he walked that became known as Timacpalco, which means impression of the hands. The Spanish priest who recorded the local traditions in the Florentine Codex unfortunately did not identify the exact location of that Timacpalco, but paleontologists have actually found fossilized dinosaur and megafauna trackways in several places across the lands previously inhabited by the Mexica. And just in case you haven't seen any dinosaur tracks, especially those that are within this type of stone in this region, they do look like giant footprints that are pressed into melted stone because they're pressed into mud or soft sediments that then harden over time and then are preserved. So, I mean, even as a child, I would go see dinosaur tracks near where I grew up in Texas, and we would make up stories about them and giants and creatures and monsters before we knew exactly what dinosaurs they actually belonged to. So it's not difficult to imagine that ancient people coming across the same tracks would connect them to the story of a god who could easily reshape the earth with his steps. Another version of the creation stories for the fifth son is that a giant sea monster who in Nahuatl is called Cipactli, or Cipac in Yucatan Maya. And this creature lived in the primordial ocean before any land was formed. And his brother Textlacopoca actually killed it and then ripped it apart and formed the land from its body. Different geological formations like mountains and river valleys have been identified as different parts of this monster. The Quiche have their own version called Zipacna, but he was a land monster instead of a sea monster. So the land already existed, and this was a little bit later after their creation. According to the story preserved in the Popol Vuh, which is the codex that preserves the Quiche traditions, he killed the beings or spirits that were known as the 400 boys, who became what we now call the Pleiades. So in revenge, the hero twins of Mayan myth, they actually killed Zipacna by luring him into underground tunnels and then trapping him. And again, there's still various geological formations that are associated with the place where he was trapped, or potentially places that were raised because he raged immediately after he was trapped. So it's interesting to see this land giant monster association. And it was also depicted as kind of a range between shark-like and crocodile-like, depending on the art styles regionally and as far as like time periods go. And it often had mixes of features of both. And one of the most famous depictions has a single sharp tooth shown prominently and separately from other teeth in the mouth of this giant shark crocodile beast. In some versions, both in the Mexica and the Maya traditions, he was also depicted actually with having very, very sharp teethy mouths all over his body, like essentially at every single joint. So there's a unique range of a very specific depiction and association with teeth. And the interesting thing there is that in 2016, at the Maya site of El Zotz, that we now call it today, it's a site that's very far from the coast, but archaeologists have found fossilized shark teeth that were buried in ritual caches. Some were likely traded, especially more recent non-fossilized teeth, especially from a lot of the coastal communities that would have found them more easily. But some of them specifically do come from species that have been extinct for millions of years, like the megalodon, whose fossils are actually found inland and not on the coast because that's where the land was previously submerged. And it was a lot deeper so the megalodons could swim through. The context of the ritual burials seemed to indicate that they, along with some other fossilized oceanic remains, could have been meant to symbolize the primordial sea in essentially recreations of the creation story as a sort of New Year celebration or potentially even lunar cycle celebration. Unfortunately, we don't have a lot of details yet as researchers are uncovering more and more from these older periods where a lot of the traditions were kind of jumbled up and almost lost due to the Spanish conquest of the Maya. But it has been also theorized that this whole view of the fossilized shark teeth as this mythical primordial monster is very similar to the medieval Europeans who viewed narwhal tusks as unicorn horns. So it's a valid comparison across human cultures that it's human nature to tend to associate physical objects from nature that sort of confirm the stories that were already believed. So it's not necessarily that these shark teeth completely shaped the imagery of Sipak or Tzipactli, more so that it like reinforced the traditions that he was associated with the earth and a giant, toothy, terrifying monster.
Now we'll head to the area that's now commonly called the American Southwest, especially Arizona and New Mexico. Bits of Nevada, Utah, and Colorado as well are generally included in that. And this region has tons of fossils and tracks from all three dinosaur-heavy periods, and then even all of the periods that didn't have dinosaurs but did have megafauna. So there's like Triassic, Jurassic, Cretaceous, again, like all sorts. I won't sit here and name them all. The sediment layers that were deposited over time by ancient seas and then lakes and then rivers built up over time in a way that preserved the layers very well. And then tectonic activity happened hundreds of thousands of years ago after all of these fossils were preserved that shoved a lot of these layers up and then exposed them for us to easily see in places like the Painted Desert or the Petrified Forest or the Grand Canyon. There's lots of wind erosion and then water erosion during the rainy seasons or from rivers that occurs in this area. And this will cause fossils to seemingly appear out of nowhere. And this process has been happening for a very long time. It's nothing new. There's no way that the indigenous people who have lived in the area didn't see them. The ancestral Puebloans once lived here, and their descendants still do, and they have preserved oral stories over generations that do incorporate fossils and fossilized tracks. I'll share some Hopi and Zuni examples that are from much older ancestral traditions, and then some stories from the Diné, which are commonly known as the Navajo, who moved to the region later from the north, and then they syncretized their ancestral myths with the local geography and the finds here. Among the Hopi, there are creatures, spirits, or kachinas in their culture that are called Pululukon, and they're said to guard freshwater sources like springs and rivers, and they bring rain. The Zuni have a similar spirit, though it was an individual named Kolowisi. In both traditions, they're often depicted as horned and winged serpents, similar to Quetzalcoatl's imagery, and also similar to Quetzalcoatl, they're associated with dinosaur track sites and not just fossils. The Hopi specifically honor Pululukon during a ceremony known as the Snake Dance, and curiously, even though the Pululukon are depicted as snake-like with no feet, the ceremonial dress that's worn by the Hopi dancers who perform the dance depicts shapes that look a lot like tridactyl or three-toed dinosaur tracks. Descendants have specifically confirmed that these shapes are associated with the three-toed tracks from Dilophosaurus that are commonly found around the mesas where the Hopi live. Whether or not they specifically originally associated these with Pululukon, or it's possible that because of the nature of the geology, the desert's got very red sandstone that will stand out in the rain whenever there's any sort of indent or depression that's actually harder to see when it's just dry and sun. So during heavy rainfall and afterwards, the fossil tracks, especially the three-toed ones that are nearby, would stand out. And so it's very probable that that's how these became associated with a legless water serpent, because they would appear after the rain. The horned aspect of Pululucan and Kolawisi are thought to be inspired by the fossils of many species of ceratops that have been found in the region. There's even one named after the Zuni, called Zuni Ceratops, that had two large horns and then a large frill. And there were many other ceratops species that lived in this area and have left their fossils that have been found even today. There's still tons being found. In Diné traditions, there's a story of another horned being named Tilgat, but this one is malicious, and he's said to burrow through the earth and attack travelers. He's eventually defeated by one of the heroes of Diné traditions with the help of Ground Squirrel, and his bones were left buried in the earth. Some paleontologists have compared descriptions and depictions of him to fossils of Pentaceratops, which is one of the many ceratops species found in the area. And that was a dinosaur with, again, large horns, five this time, and a large frill. And there's also a different dinosaur called a Placerius, which was tusked and built more like a hippo or rhino, though it was more reptilian. Either of these, based on their horns or tusks and the way their skulls are shaped, could have easily inspired a legend about a dangerous horned creature that came from underground, or reinforced the story that was already there in their ancient traditions that they brought with them from the north. Another malicious monster from Diné's traditions and stories is described as a giant covered in armor plates, and sometimes it's said that he has horns or spikes. His name is Yaitso, and a lot of the descriptions and depictions of him match up to the most iconic fossils of North America, in my opinion. I suppose we have quite a lot with like T-Rex and all of that, but the ankylosaurs were native to our area, and a lot of fossils have been specifically found in the Southwest. Several species lived in the area that specifically did become Diné land. The armor of ankylosauruses is caused by bony plates and spikes that covered their backs, and so these are preserved fairly well within the fossil record. Also, in case you've never seen an ankylosaur's skull, it almost looks like a skull cap. Because of the nature of their bony plates of armor, they tend to actually outlast the bone. And so the bony plates that were on top of the head often last longer than the rest of the skull. And with just that, they look fairly human-shaped. They're like fairly rounded, but much larger. I'll be sure to share pictures on social media and links. Ankylosaurs are just very cool. And their fossils very easily fit the descriptions of Yaitso, and again, are examples of the ways that these myths existed and then were kind of reinforced by the geology and paleontology of the world around them. In the case of Diné traditions and stories, we know that a lot of these were shaped by the world around them as they experienced it in the Southwest, because they came from the North and have shared ancestors that still live in the North and have similar traditions that are shaped more closely with their environment. One example is the Kugupuk, who is from Yupik traditions, and they're depicted as enormous tusked creatures, very toothy as well, lots of sharp teeth, and they're said to burrow through the earth and attack travelers, very, very similar to Tilgat. One interesting difference between the Kugupuk and the Tilgat are that there's multiple Kugupuk. It's not seen as a singular. They're like a species of creatures in a way. And it's said that they turn to stone if fresh air touches them, which is why they burrow through the ground, except for one night each year. But sometimes they'll be tricked into burrowing out outside of that one night that they're allowed, or sometimes they'll be caught out longer than they were supposed to stay out, and that one night ends before they're able to get underground. A lot of depictions of them show them with huge bodies and large mammoth-like tusks. And in the area, every spring especially, the areas where Yupik have lived for generations, thousands of years, fossils are exposed along the riverbanks, and especially in more recent years as climate change is causing a lot of the permafrost to thaw, but mammoth bones and tusks are very common there. In a very specific example, one of the best preserved woolly mammoths was found very close to Swan Point archaeological site, which is one of the oldest human habitation sites in Alaska, and therefore one of the oldest in all of the Americas, and it's within Yupik ancestral lands. It's very unlikely that that is the only well-preserved mammoth that would have been in this entire area, and it's very unlikely that it wouldn't have been seen or similar ones given how close it was to this settlement where people lived for a lot of the year, and they would have been using the land around them, digging, or at the very least having livestock who are grazing. And so the land would have eventually exposed fossils given the way that it exposes them now. And even some of the pictures of paleontologists who have gone into Alaska and into these regions that were previously Yupik ancestral lands, you can see fossils sticking out of areas that previously were frozen that have started melting, and they look very similar to what I'd imagine that creatures caught in the middle of attempting to dig their way out of or back into the earth would look like. And so it's very easy to connect those myths. And a lot of descendant communities have said that they think that was the inspiration as well. Myths about cycles of creation and destruction, or mythical beings that could be associated with fossils, are not unique to the Americas. In Ireland, for example, their traditions state that the land of Ireland has been settled, destroyed, and renewed in many different cycles, and their mythologies are even referred to as the cycles, various named cycles, the mythological cycle, the Ulster cycle, etc. During each cycle, a different race or species of beings reigned over the earth, and most of the time were either usurped by the next species that was coming along in the cycle, though there were a couple instances where they were wiped out in some sort of natural disaster. Now, Ireland's got famous bogs that preserve plants, animals, and even humans for thousands of years. Some researchers have suggested that the discovery of extinct animals alongside long-dead people in the bogs may have reinforced these stories, especially when it came to the human-like gods who would fight the monstrous beings of the previous cycle in order to gain control of the world. So this could be the visible evidence that they needed, I say needed in quotes, to prove that the previous worlds did exist. When farmers began unearthing giant skeletons in the 1700s and 1800s in Ireland, texts from that time identified them as the bones of giants and associated them with the ancient heroes and monsters from their traditions. By the late 1800s to the early 1900s, Irish scholars wrote that these bog monsters were often just the remains of Irish elk or prehistoric people. And Irish elk were massive Ice Age deer, and they had the largest antlers of any species of deer. So way out of context for the people of Ireland who would not have ever seen antlers of that size before. And so you see these giant 3-meter-wide antlers and bones of these species that are much larger than the ones that exist today. And you're likely going to start creating some stories or associating them with the giants that already existed in your stories from the past. Now, Irish elk went extinct about 10,000 years ago, and they did live actually across Eurasia, but they're specifically named Irish elk because most specimens of the species have been found in Irish bogs. So we know that this was such a common thing in the 1800s and 1900s. It was likely also as common prior to that as people were digging up, especially peat was a common thing that would be harvested or farmed essentially from bogs. And that would be used for several different things, fertilizer, sometimes fuel for fire, etc. So you have people already digging in these bogs. They're definitely going to be finding these things just the same as more modern people were. Early 20th century Irish scholars were actually the first to suggest that the Irish elk remains inspired many of the pre-Christian stories of beasts or giant humans that had remained throughout the Christian persecution of pagans in Ireland. But despite the widely accepted scientific identification of the time, Irish elk bones were still very high-value items that were sold across Europe to be displayed both scientifically by museums to showcase the extinct species of Irish elk, but also in pseudoscientific displays of curiosities and alleged proof of mythical beings. So even as early as 100 to 120 years ago, people were still believing that these Irish elk remains were actually the remains of ancient mythical giants or monsters. Next, we'll take a look at some Greek examples, because as I shared in the previous episode, Greek and Roman writers left quite a lot of written records, comparatively with the rest of the world, that actually record fossil discoveries and the myths that they inspired. It wasn't only dragons that they associated with fossils like the ones that I had shared before. There were other large beasts and giant heroes as well. The Caledonian boar is the first example, which was a giant, ferocious boar sent by Artemis to terrorize the Greek city of Caledon because its ruler had offended her, either by intentionally or accidentally failing to give her offerings at an annual celebration for all of the gods. After this boar began to terrorize the countryside, the king gathered several heroes together to hunt down the boar, which was finally killed after quite a lot of troubles. It's said that disputes during the hunt led to quite a lot of bad blood between heroes that led to political disputes between city-states. Because of the political aspect of it and the cultural identity behind these political disputes associated with those tied to heroes, it became a trophy to display the alleged tusks of the Caledonian boar by various temples, especially temples dedicated to Artemis in the ancient world. According to some writers, Romans would even come later and take these trophies of the Caledonian boar from the temples where they were housed, and one of the most famous ones was taken by Augustus and brought to Rome. It was later seen by the geographer Pausanias, allegedly, and he said that one of the tusks that had been looted by Augustus was already disintegrated, but the other one that still remained was over 3 feet or 1 meter long. Other writers don't give quite as specific measurements, but they compare them to elephant tusks, nowhere near the average 10 inches or 25 centimeters that were common for the wild boars that actually live in the area. So much, much larger than any natural boar of the time could have been. But those size specifications and other descriptions match up to mammoth tusks, many of which have been dug up around the Mediterranean, especially in Greece. Given how important the Caledonian boar's tusks were for displaying a bit of like cultural identity and pride, it would not be a far stretch to assume that these were actually mammoth tusks that were found and then placed on display in very prominent places. Another example from Greek and Roman sources describe the discovery of huge bones near Troy that were said to belong to the hero Ajax, made famous by Homer's Iliad. And he was one of the heroes of the Trojan War. Basically, only Achilles was more stronger than him. According to Homer and then writers who came later and elaborated on a lot of the myths that he wrote down, Ajax had been killed during the Trojan War at the gates of Troy, and he was buried on a sea cliff near Troy. Centuries after the Trojan War was said to have taken place, it was said that a huge storm washed away a large portion of a sea cliff near Troy and exposed the massive bones, and they were assumed to be those of Ajax based on where they were located. It was also widely believed in classical Greece that the people who were ancient even to them, like the heroes of the Trojan War, were much larger than humans of their time. So given that context and finding these ancient bones exposed on the sea cliff and knowing that the area was famously the burial place of Ajax, it's easy to see how they could jump to that conclusion. According to later writers, the Emperor Hadrian was passing through Troy whenever these bones were exposed, and so he had them ceremoniously reburied during the 2nd century CE. There are some kernels of truth in the myths surrounding the tomb of Ajax that archaeologists and paleontologists have been able to sort of confirm. We do know that Hadrian visited Troy, and he did have several sites restored during his visit, including a tumulus that's been called the Tomb of Ajax since at least the 1st century BCE. Hadrian was reportedly a big fan of Hellenistic myths, and so it's not surprising that he would restore a place already associated with the mythological hero Ajax. It seemed to have been a bit of a tourist attraction in the ancient world to actually stop by here and see the Tomb of Ajax. And there are actually quite a few tumuli around Troy and its surrounding region. The majority of them predate Hellenistic or classical Greece. So you have the combination of these very, very old tombs, some dating back to the Bronze Age, even a few that actually date back to the Neolithic period, over 2,000 years before Homer wrote the Trojan War in the Iliad. So that combined with finds of giant fossils nearby, especially in sea cliffs, it's common after major sea storms for large portions of the coast to erode away very quickly. And in that area, there's a lot of fossils to be found. The area, and especially the seaside cliffs in Troy, which is in modern-day Turkey, does contain Miocene fossil beds, and they have lots of mammals like mastodon, deer, and rhinoceros remains. These species were all much larger than their modern counterparts, and also it's been proven that there are several examples throughout semi-modern and medieval history of these specific creatures having their bones pieced together in a way to look more humanoid. It would be easy to add these to the myth of Ajax and his ancient tumulus there on the seaside cliffs. And while there are truly tons of examples from around the world, I'm actually going to go into only one last example, or else this podcast would last forever. So on the island of Samos, there are two different myths associated with giants and the giant fossils that have been found there. Ancient texts describe these giants known as the Neades, who could cause earthquakes just by roaring, but this also is what led to their own demise, and all of them were eventually wiped out by earthquakes. It was said that after humans began to populate the island because it was safe for them, the bones of the Neades were put on display in temples on the island. Another myth about Samos specifically identifies a place known as Panaima, which roughly translates to place of blood, where it's said that Dionysus defeated the Amazons, and the ground is forever stained with the blood of the Amazons and littered with the bones of them and their horses. Most of the ground on the island of Samos is brown to grayish, except for the Mytilene formation, which has more iron oxides in the sediment that formed there than the rest of the island. And the iron oxide there makes the soil red. So it's been heavily, heavily suggested that this was the origin of the place called Panaima. Within the Mytilene Formation, modern paleontologists have identified large fossilized bones there, including those belonging specifically to Dinotherium gigantium, which is the Miocene relative of elephants and mammoths that went extinct just before mammoths evolved and came onto the scene. And also the fossils of Hipparion, which is an extinct three-toed relative of horses, and Samotherium, which is an extinct relative of giraffes, and their modern scientific name specifically means the beast of Samos. And archaeological evidence shows that the ancient inhabitants of Samos found and collected some of these fossils from this site. Archaeologists have found fossils around the ruins of a temple dedicated specifically to on Samos, and these contexts show that they were intentionally reburied there and not originally deposited there and just happened to be near the temple. There's also another temple of Hera in Olympia where it said that a giant bone, which has been interpreted as a fossil or a mammoth bone, was placed on display there as well. So it's interesting that Hera was associated with these fossils in multiple places. Thanks for joining me for episode 29. And these examples from all around the world and the examples of dragons from the previous episode are meant to show that no matter who we are or what era we live in, humans have always tried to understand the world around us. We may have a more accurate picture of what dinosaurs looked like now, at least as far as we know, compared to centuries or even millennia ago, but that's all thanks to the people who came before us, who were fascinated by these curious bones they found and wanted to learn more. Just as modern scientists combine biological facts with their imaginations to depict the dinosaurs and megafauna as we see them today, ancient people would also use their knowledge of the natural world around them alongside their imaginations to try to piece together what these remains of unknown creatures they found might have looked like. These tales also show us that just like modern stories like Jurassic Park or Jurassic World, both franchises are huge, and our predecessors from the far, far past also imagined what it would be like if these long extinct bones came to life. Thanks again for listening both to this episode and the podcast on a whole throughout the year. I look forward to sharing more of the past macabre with you in 2026. Thanks, and until next time. Thanks for listening. Be sure to subscribe to keep up with new releases. Please leave a rating and a comment. That helps the show reach others who may be interested in the past macabre. For access to bonus content from all Archaeology Podcast Network shows, become a member at archpodnet.com/members. That's archpodnet.com/members. You can find show notes for this and other episodes at archpodnet.com/TPM and follow Past Macabre on Instagram. That's PAST_MACABRE. You'll find pictures of the sites and artifacts discussed, Q&A sessions, and episode topic votes. Hope to see you there.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy. Our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht. And our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultura Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.